Thanks for listening in and joining us on the Australian Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Russell Jarrett, physical performance coach, health club owner, fitness educator, and yes, all-round fitness geek. I'm the guy who probably trains on Christmas Day. I would rather lift a barbell than drink a beer, and I'm a student of all things training and physical improvement. So what are we all about here at the Australian Fitness Podcast? Let me set the scene for you. If you've dabbled in training, exercise, weight loss, muscle gain, getting stronger, getting leaner, running further, or have even the slightest interest in fitness and training, I think you'll get a lot out of this podcast. Jackie Lauder is a ridiculously qualified and experienced sports psychologist. She's worked at the elite level of sports since 1998 in the AFL, netball, ice hockey, cycling, tennis, rugby, motorsports, even croquet. So when I got the chance to get her on the podcast, you can imagine I jumped at it. The first sports psych we've had on the show, and wow, what a great podcast it turned out to be. Sometimes when you interview someone, you can just tell that they ooze knowledge. The depth of their answers is so detailed that it just leaves you with more questions than what you actually started with. And this was one of those interviews. The more I asked her, the more I realized that she just had so much to give. I really enjoyed this chat with Jackie, and the content that she brings is absolute gold. It's an extra bonus that I managed to interview her and escape unscathed. I kept her relatively distracted, and therefore she didn't get to analyze me too closely. I definitely will be getting her back for another chat. On a side note, the Australian Fitness Podcast is really starting to grow a following. I really started this as a hobby and to bring quality guests and real content to an industry that I love, but one that I feel is drowning under the weight of pretenders and what I term Instagram wankers. So if you can, help me to continue to grow the show, leave a review, tell your friends, share us around on social media, and always feel free to email me with feedback, good or bad. The email is info@AustralianFitnessPodcast.com.au. If you're listening to this and you feel that you have a viewpoint or a career that's worth an interview, hit me up or let me know of someone in your world that you feel is worth having on the show. Enjoy the podcast. Australian Fitness Podcast, episode 27, and today I'm joined by Jackie Lauder, who's a sports psychologist, and we're going to go deep into all things sports psychology and things in sport and physical performance that are related to elements above the shoulders and not below the shoulders. So this is kind of a foreign environment for me. I deal very much in bodies. Jackie will be dealing very much in the mind. So she's probably going to open up a few maybe closets of my brain as well. I'm a bit scared about this. But Jackie Lauder, good morning and thanks for joining the podcast. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Now, your background is both long and distinguished.
Old.
Yeah. No. You've just got a great field of experience. What's your primary role at the moment? So, who are you dealing with at the moment, and what's kind of your workspace look like at this point?
Yeah. So at the moment, I've got a couple of balls in the air, which is pretty normal. So my base is I have a clinical practice set up at Olympic Park Sports Medicine. So based in Melbourne, they're doing that. And then I'm the club psychologist for Melbourne Storm. So I spend quite a few hours per week there. And then I also work with the Collingwood Football Club, but in their women's division. So the two programs that are key in that is the AFLW program and the SSN netball,
right?
Which is great. And then was supposed to be finishing up. I've done swimming for the last 3-4 Olympics. So literally this week we were supposed to be in Adelaide at Olympic trials.
Right.
But as we know, that's all been postponed. So I've been with swimming for quite some time. So I spend once a week with them and then look after their athletes and then just do some different consulting at different times, like run coaching courses with helping coaches understand the psychological components. So they're just sort of ad hoc things. So yep. It's pretty busy and nice variety for me.
Absolutely. So the thing that interests me too is the fact that you've been involved across a range of sports, and I mean that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, psychology is so applicable to all sorts of sports. A bit like S&C. I mean, you know, my job is to improve the body of an athlete, regardless of what sport they're involved in. And for you, I guess it's all about the mental approach to their sport, regardless of the sport that they're involved in.
Yeah, 100%. And it's interesting too, like I spent 13 years working at the National Surface Institute. So they're performers in a very different way. So you will get, I get a lot of clients come through the clinic that might be actors, musicians, opera singers, because it's all performance. So the real key difference, I think, is when you get involved in a new sport, really important for me to learn the language
yep.
of that sport. So I spent, you know, quite a long time working through Motorcycling Australia with all their dirt bike riders, road bike, and I didn't grow up with motorbikes.
Yep.
So
yep.
It was important for me to learn the language, and because particularly when you're doing performance stuff, you have to understand how their event runs, you know, what the key words are, what the components of the performance are. So it keeps it interesting because I'm learning sports that I just would have never had anything to do with. And you become, you know, very interested. Like even as a Victorian, AFL was always the football you followed. But
yeah.
having been involved in Storm, I could quite easily and often will put now an NRL game on before an AFL game.
Yep, yep.
Which, you know, I would never have thought I would do. But once you understand the game, you have a real appreciation for it.
Well, when you work at the level that you do and you're dealing with people on a very personal level, you kind of, it's very hard to not get bought into that, isn't it? You have such a connection with these people. It would be weird if you didn't buy in and get involved in their sport and in their life and in their level of success. So it makes yeah. complete sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you also understand, I guess, how important it is to them, and you understand the stresses that come with that, particularly if you're looking at your really high-profile sports. And as we're seeing at the moment, obviously through all this COVID, that AFL and NRL are clearly the two prime sports from a public perspective
yep.
because they're the two that are on air and got up and running quickly.
Yep.
So this now more than ever, certainly when I started, we never had all the social media. It was just starting to come in. So we never had it the way we do now.
Yep.
So where I'm finding athletes' stresses and anxieties and everything else, it's not just within themselves. It's caused by a lot of the external over criticized, publicized commentary on their performances from every avenue now, the public as well as the professional commentators.
Let's expand on that, because that was kind of along the lines of one of the questions I had here on my notes, and that is this: why are we so more aware, or are we more aware, or just more sensitive to the whole topic of mental health, anxiety, depressive tendencies? So my question is this: are athletes more affected by those sorts of problems these days because of the environment they live in, or are we just more aware of it? How do you see it?
I actually think it's both.
Right.
You know, humans have always had opinions.
Mm.
Now they've got more forums to express them.
Yep.
So which means now because we're hearing them more, they have a bigger impact. But they've always been there. So athletes for years, and it's interesting to see, you know, so many athletes that have gone through that transition and retired that are also now acknowledging, you know what, I've actually battled mental health for years. I just never knew what to call it. I always thought it was only me. So we're getting a lot of transition issues coming up from the past, which is such a huge area. And this is why, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in a sport that has a players association or organization that can support you with that, it's so vital.
Yep.
And I think now, because there is more education, like we've always had mental health, just like we have physical health, everybody has it.
Yep.
It's just, is it in a good space or not such a good space? But I think now we're making it okay to talk about it. We're destigmatizing it and saying this is normal. It doesn't mean, you know, if you used to go and see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, everyone would just say, think you're crazy. Well, I don't see people who are crazy. I see people who just need strategies
yep.
to deal with various things, and they've got certain issues. No different to a doctor who goes, well, that person's got a sore knee and that person's got a sore shoulder, or you in strength and conditioning that says, well, their core's not so good, but, you know, their lower body strength is great or whatever.
Yep.
It's exactly the same. And I think that's for me, in the environments that I'm in, it's really healthy, and I take it as a big win when, you know, an athlete can say, oh, yeah, I'm going to see the physio, I'm going to see the doc, or I'm just going to catch up with Jackie, or like it's literally that smooth now.
Yep, yep.
Which says that it's well accepted, yes. There's no stigma attached, and players and athletes are comfortable to go, this is okay, I'm fine with this, and I don't care if people know about it.
Well, I mean, I think athletes these days are now seeing a session with the sports psychologist or a regular catch-up with the sports psychologist as nothing more than just their it's nothing more than their overall preparation of their ability to perform at their highest. It's like going to do a strength session or going to do a conditioning session. I'm going to catch up with a sports psychologist because that's part of my preparation to play at my optimal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was interesting. I had I was on a Zoom call yesterday with someone from one of the sporting organisations in Scotland, and they were just because you obviously get linked in with so many people from different countries and sports, and they were just sort of picking my brain about this is an area we haven't developed so much and we want to and that. So now, you know, organisations from all over the world are connecting and reaching out going, how do we do this better and how do we look after our athletes and how do we put this into our programs, and which, you know, for us is amazing because when I went through study, a lot of people sort of said, what is that? You'll never get a job.
Yep.
You know, getting discouraged from studying it, I was just lucky I had supportive parents and friends and that who said, no, go for it.
Yep.
And now we're sitting on the other side going, we are so busy. But the education side is the part for me that we need to make sure we get right at this stage because it is so new. And, you know, we use a lot of psychological terms inappropriately like from a social perspective. Like if someone's having a mood swing, everyone's like, oh, they've got bipolar. That's a terrible thing to say.
Yeah, that's pretty extreme, and that's a diagnosable condition, but it's a very serious condition. You can't just throw that around.
No, and so that's what I think from an education perspective we're trying to do now, and this is where sort of all your mental health first aids and all those are really good because they're starting to provide the right language around it. You're not crazy if you see a psychologist. No, you don't have bipolar. You're having some mood disturbances just because you've had a few low days. That's not grieving. That's depression, or that's depression. That's not grieving, or whatever it is.
Yep.
So I think we're getting better and better at doing that, but it's got a long way to go, but gee, it's come so far in the last, I'd say, 20 years.
Oh, certainly. And you know, one of the things that intrigues me, Jackie, is the fact that as a society, and especially in the sporting landscape, it's almost like people don't like feelings. No one likes to feel sad, but being sad or having a down day or being a bit flat is kind of a normal thing.
Yeah.
Yet people feel like, oh, I've got to be up and happy and in control and have my shit together all the time. But that's just no one is like that.
No, it's actually not possible. And it's really interesting because when you say to people –
well, also not healthy. Like you have to understand that if you're sad, that is a normal human emotion and it will pass. And you need to learn the strategies to manage that mindset.
Yeah. And I think it's where we've probably gone wrong in the past, and you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but I don't know how your schooling and your education was, but I certainly cannot remember anything through my education where they taught us to understand feelings. We label them, and most adults tend to use the same 5 or 6 words to describe everything they feel. And so teaching people how to use the right word for the right feeling, but also that, you know, if someone passes away and people say, oh, you know, you'll be okay, I know that, but it's not okay that person's passed.
Yep.
And it's okay for me to grieve, and it's okay for me to take a little while with that. And I can still function, but I'm functioning at a lower level because I've got a hole there, I'm hurting.
Yes.
And that's okay. And I think now we're hearing more and more people say it's okay to not be okay, which is it's really nice to hear that because it is every single human. Like
absolutely.
No one is motivated every day of their life. And if they tell you they are, they're lying.
Yeah.
like you might have moments in each day where you feel motivated, but, you know, I'm a very driven person and disciplined and I'm highly motivated, but not every day. Some days I want to have a doona day as well where I just want to stay inside and do nothing.
Doona day. I like it. I like it. Yeah. I feel like over the last 12 weeks there's been way too many options to have doona days though.
Yeah. Yes, now we're trying to say to people, you must get dressed every day.
Well, I mean, just on that note, I mean, I've got three sons. Two of them are young. One of them's 20, and he was in his first year of uni. He had to come home from Deakin. But I got to say, I think my three kids have managed very well. But I certainly noticed a point through all of the lockdown phase. I reckon it was about 6 or 7 weeks in, where their mood shifted noticeably. They became quiet. They became sulky is not the right word. Just withdrawn. Melancholy. Withdrawn. Yeah. Sort of flat and tired, and they were sleeping way too much. Their appetite was off. They literally, I believe that they were, I don't know what you would call it. You tell me. But they were suffering
some. Depressive symptoms.
It was no doubt in my mind it was because they couldn't go see friends, they didn't have school, they didn't have that normal social interaction, they didn't have a structure as much as we tried to provide them with it. You know, it's just not normal human behaviour to go through that. So I reckon there's been a lot of people that have really found it difficult during this time.
Oh, yeah. I think that's that 6 week mark that you talked about was pretty spot on, because I've certainly noticed through my clinical practice that the amount and the intensity of people that have never really suffering anxiety.
Yeah.
Showing lower moods, having what they've described as meltdowns when they have never experienced that before. But I think that, you know, the thing with all of this has been the human brain is a social organ. It needs connection. And we've always used it as a bit of a social term, like, oh, I felt connected to that person.
Yep.
Or, you know, really, we really clicked. Whilst we've been using those terms, there is physiologically inside your brain, if you and I are having a conversation where we're really connecting, the same parts of our frontal lobe light up if we were to put you in an fMRI machine.
Yep.
And there's been studies showing that. So when all of a sudden humans are isolated, and my concern has always been for the people that live on their own, and the elderly who don't have huge social connections as well, that what it does is it increases symptoms of, you know, dementia or degeneration and that, because we're not using, similar to what you would say to your clients, you don't use your body, you lose it.
Yep.
Your brain's a bit the same. Is that if you don't use parts of it. So when we're not using that, when we're lacking our daily purpose and something to get up for, and also that feeling of contributing to something, like, you know, especially when we're part of sporting teams and organizations, you're part of something that's bigger than yourself, and that's, I love that.
Yeah.
But when you're not doing that every day, that's such a huge change to not be, you know, contributing to something bigger.
Yeah. I just want to change tact for a second to something you mentioned earlier. When you're dealing with different sports, and you've dealt with many over the years, do you find that there is a very specific personality type that tends to gravitate towards certain sports? Like, for instance, I would imagine that, I'm not trying to label or typecast here, but I would imagine that it would be kind of your alpha males that would gravitate towards rugby league and AFL, whereas it might be a different personality type that would gravitate towards perhaps golf or skateboarding, something where you need to be a bit more laid back and a bit more casual. Do you agree or disagree, or where do you see that?
Yeah, not really.
Okay.
I don't really see that. We definitely have some of the personalities through our big contact sports that are very soft and empathetic,
right,
and whatever. It's much more about the individual, and I guess the thing that I've probably seen over the years is it's a little bit more of the individual sport versus the team orientation,
right,
rather than the aggressiveness of the sport, because the people are competitive. It doesn't matter which sport they're choosing, but there are certain personalities that don't want to leave anything to chance. And I remember seeing an interview, I think it was with Leighton Hewitt once, and he was saying that because he had such an avid following for AFL, but he said, you know, I want my performance to be because I've tried. I don't want to go out there and I'm slogging my guts out and somebody else doesn't try and so I lose.
Yeah. See, so that's the more, that's individual, isn't it, versus team
very
sport.
Much.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's much more that than it is because they're all hugely competitive.
Mm.
And as you would know, having been around elite sport, like athletes can, and even the people within it, we're also the same personalities. It's amazing what you can make a competition out of.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think even if people have watched that Michael Jordan, Last Dance.
How good was that?
Over the break. You know, when I think he was in the change rooms once and they were just tossing a coin who could get it closest to the wall and then all of a sudden it became a competition.
And deadly laughed. Serious. Deadly serious. Yes. Like he lost that coin throw and he was pissed, wasn't he? Mm. Really?
Yeah, and that's like I said, we see that all the time in sporting organizations. It's something that starts as a generic conversation turns into it, right? You know, put your money where your mouth is. which is part of it. That's the funnest part of it.
Sure.
Is when that stuff happens. So, yeah, it's more an individual personality that drives you, I think, towards the individual sport or the team orientation.
Let me ask you this. I've worked in sports that involve both males and females. Do you see a difference in how you deal with female athletes versus male athletes? I find from an S&C point of view, there are a few differences in how they approach their training.
Yep.
Not in how I train them. I treat them all the same because a body is a body. They do respond slightly differently, but to get a female strong, it's essentially the same process as a male. But I have noticed over the years that they do approach their preparation differently. What are your thoughts?
Yes. Yeah, 100%. You know, there are some physiological differences between a male and a female brain. So, you know, females are a bit more of the tend and befriend and the guys are a bit more about just the getting the job done, the structure. So if you have a look at kids' sport and a girl goes down, all the other girls run to her to make sure she's okay.
Mm. That nurture instinct, isn't it?
Yeah, and when one of the boys goes down, you'll say to them at the end of the session, oh, you know, Jimmy fell over. Oh, I didn't even notice.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, and it's not that they don't care, but there are real differences in how they cope with things and that. And not from the competitive side. The females are just as competitive and just as driven and there's nothing from that side. But how you speak to them, the language that you use, even things like there's been some research around if you put a video up of for the females where you're doing a video analysis, the girls will look at how they look first, whereas the boys look at the skill.
Yeah.
And you hear it in their comments, oh, my God, I can't believe I look like that, or I don't look very good in that. I never hear those comments from the males. It's all about the skill. So, you know, until you've got that real understanding of one of the girls, I'm very aware of what we put in front of them and how we talk to them. And not that I'm not aware with the boys, but it is definitely different language, which is fine. Like they're different people.
Sure. What about like when you, you know, in your work, have you found over time sort of a common thread amongst athletes? The question I'm coming at here is, are there any kind of common apprehensions or fears or reservations or, you know, what are the... Is it fear of performance? Is it fear of failure? What are the common things that athletes come to you with as opposed to just a general population person who doesn't necessarily have to perform in front of an audience?
I think what would probably surprise a lot of people is, you know, I think they think all these athletes are super confident and whatever, and in actual fact, not so much.
Yeah.
Because they're so hypercritical of themselves. And even if they've played amazing, the amount of praise they need, support they need, and especially too, I think now that there are so many media social outlets where everybody criticizes them, even more important, that we make sure we give them that praise and make them feel safe, because it's a very unsafe world out there for them when everyone, you know, we don't go to work every day and on the front page of the paper tomorrow everyone discusses our performance.
Yeah.
But they do.
Yes.
You know, even when they train, people will comment, oh, you know, been struggling at training or didn't turn up, and you're like, well, no one cares if I don't turn up for work. So
exactly.
Why is that news? But so I think that, you know, certainly that confidence, that hypercritical of themselves. A lot of anxiety with performance, the what ifs, because they put so much time and effort. And, you know, particularly if you're looking at an Olympic athlete who the Olympics is once every 4 years. Mm. Now, they have obviously competitions between, but the pinnacle for them is once every 4 years. The pinnacle for most other sports is once a year, the grand final.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So, or they're making finals and whatever. So
if they have a bad game this week, they can attune for it next week.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. And that's what you kind of get judged on is you know, a number of performances. Whereas, you know, you go to Olympic trials for swimming and you could have been the fastest last week, but if you don't pull that out today, you ain't on that team.
Yeah.
And that's like, wow, you know.
That's pressure.
Often it's, you know, it's half a fingernail
that
they miss out on. So 4 years worth of work comes down to half a fingernail. That is devastating for them. So I think, you know, the other side now is because there is so much analysis and statistics, speak to a lot of athletes about how much they can get stuck on the really, really small things and then move away way too much on how they feel.
Yep.
And I said athletes all the time, there's not going to be a single statistic that's going to tell you something about your game you didn't already know purely because you were the one out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might not realize you had 12 tackles. You might have thought you had around 10.
Yep.
But that doesn't change the fact that you knew you had a high tackle game.
Yes.
So I think we're seeing a lot more of that, and certainly a lot more athletes now being prepared to deal with their mental health. And then I guess the other side is where we're spending probably over the last few years seeing a much higher request for understanding is from the coaching groups. So coaches needing to be educated about understanding their athletes. You know, we profile now because we want to understand the human we have in front of us.
Yeah.
We're not treating them all the same anymore, and that's probably where we've had a bigger influence on coaches is explaining to them that that athlete's interpreted your speech that way and this one interpreted it this way and this one really loved it and this one felt really unsafe with it.
Yeah.
And so making coaches aware of their language and how to read their humans, and I think we've just got to keep doing that. So that's probably been the biggest step forward, I think.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned earlier that you worked with the Institute of Circus?
The National Circus Institute.
That's interesting. So obviously they're performers and you talked about actors and so forth. Walk me through some of that. So what, you know, how are you advising those types of people and what are their, you know, what are their sort of key concerns?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's different personalities because they've got two components to them. So from a performance side, same issues. Whether that be nerves before they perform, you know, overcoming injuries, worried about, you know, I guess where their next job's going to be, all those sort of things. But you've also got highly competitive, amazing athletes, and you've got hugely creative people in there. And so, again, your language and how they see things and what they choose to do, like, you know, you look at a contortionist. Well, you might want to do that, but if your body physically is not allowing that, but then they've got to put routines together and perform in front of a different type of audience, and they don't have the same systems in place for feedback other than what their audience gives them.
Yep.
And maybe a few notes from a producer. So they're very on their own in terms of how have I gone, or so they can be a lot more insular. And therefore ruminate a lot more about stuff.
But, yep.
You know, you're dealing with aerial artists, which would surprise people, that are afraid of heights.
No, come on. Really?
So, yeah, absolutely. Because
how do they end up doing that as a living?
Well, because the thing is they really love that aspect of performance.
Right.
But if they've had a fall or if it's, you know, higher than normal.
Right.
Or, yeah, that's, you know, that's not unusual to get that, which does surprise, you know, a lot of people.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you've got, again, it's, I always used to laugh when I tell people I worked at the Circus Institute, they're like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I make the sad clowns happy. And they're like, really? I'm like, no, not, like, no.
No.
Not really.
That was a joke.
But, But in some ways, it's kind of, you know, if someone clowning is their specialty,
yeah,
and they're struggling to find creativity and yeah. material that the audience actually connects with, or they're not getting the response from the audience,
yeah,
that then makes them doubt their performance.
Oh, like, hell yeah.
Maybe I'm not, you know, well, if you're, to be doing this.
If you're a clown and you perform some kind of trick or something like that, and you don't get the laugh or the immediate response mm-hmm. from the audience that you're expecting, I can imagine yeah. the next 15 to 20 seconds is a fair bit of mental anguish.
Correct. That's
what exactly the hell do right. I do now?
Yeah. And if they get on there and they forget, forget something because, or you know, they've had a a trick or something that didn't quite work out, particularly if they're part of an ensemble or whatever. Mm. And then, you know, you go to the ones that are like your musicians and those sort of performers, and I don't know how much you know about their processes, but they're brutal. Like,
really,
you go into audition for a position, say, at the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. Now, that position may only have come up once in 15 years because once someone's in, they're in.
Yep.
Right? So then you go in and they do an audition for fairness, and so it's completely based on sound. They are behind a screen.
Right.
And they don't even see who's giving them, who's assessing them.
So no feedback whatsoever.
No feedback whatsoever other than thank you.
Yep.
And then if they don't get it, and sometimes they can have positions where, you know, the position's open but they didn't actually give anyone the contract. They're just going to use someone to fill in. Like, it's so strange. So it's very intense for them because there's no feedback for them. There's no human interaction for them other than go in, stand behind a screen, perform, thank you, and then they're out of there. Like, if you are –
that's
if you
tough.
Are, footballer and you do really well and you kick goals, the crowd gives you feedback. If you're on the stage, the audience gives you feedback, good or bad.
Yep.
But for these guys, when they're auditioning, they don't often get feedback. So, you know, they're quite resilient, the musicians, because
I would imagine.
They have to be.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, that you're not getting positive or negative. So you're kind of left to, you know, I'd imagine those people are left to kind of creating their own story as to what happened.
Yep. Yeah.
And therein lies another problem, because they get up inside their own head, you know, and maybe they did an amazing performance, but they'll never know.
Yeah. And particularly because they're high achievers as well. Same personality as our athletes.
Yep.
High achievers, you know, years and years of training.
Yeah.
That they're going to be self-critical when they don't get a job more than they will. And it could have been literally nothing major.
Mm.
They will never know that. So that's a really tough gig for them.
Wow. That's something I never knew about. Interesting. Yeah. What about, Jack, what about, I call them weekend warriors. What about people that play sport primarily for the social interaction and the enjoyment and the love of the game, but they still want to do well and they still suffer anxiety. They don't want to they don't want to let their teammates down. They don't want to have a dud performance. So, you know, what are some basic strategies that your weekend warriors can put into play? Because I know plenty of people that play, you know, community A-grade football or netball, but they still have pre-game anxiety. They still have, you know, what do you say to those people, a couple of key, you know, preparation techniques, mental techniques?
Do you know what? It's often very similar because it doesn't matter what level you're playing at. If it's important to you and it means something to you, then it can create anxiety. So, you know, one of the most common things I will say to people is obviously focus on what you can control. And the things they can't control, you can't control the result because you can't control other people.
Yep.
So pick a couple of, you know, number one, know what your strengths are. So in your team, whether you're playing at D grade level or you're playing AFL or you're playing National League netball or international tennis or local tennis, know what your strengths are, because when you start to feel that stress and anxiety, your strengths are the things that make you feel better. Whereas most people tend to go and focus on what they can't do rather than what they can do.
Yep.
So that humans are control freaks. We don't like not being in control, because then we don't feel safe. We don't feel like we're going to get what we want. So I just say to them, know what your strengths are. And it's a very interesting question when you say it to people, tell me your biggest strengths. They've got no idea.
Yeah.
Or they're so uncomfortable to say it. And I'm like, you know what? confidence is an internal thing, knowing I can do this. I've got, you know, I've done all the work. Arrogance is when you go around telling everyone how good you are to make yourself feel better or to put someone else down.
Yep.
So not asking you to be arrogant, but confidence internally going, okay, you know, I'm a weekend warrior at netball and I'm playing C grade, which is for me a high level. And, you know, and if I'm playing in a goal position, okay, so it's focus on my technique when I'm shooting, think about my leads, and use my voice.
Yep.
So it's exactly the same sort of thing that you're doing at an elite level. It's just, I guess, the pressure is more internal for your weekend warrior, whereas it's internal and external.
Yep.
As you get to your higher levels. You know, with anxiety is, you know, don't sit with it, move, get on the move. Don't, you know, a lot of people just say, I'm just going to sit here for a second.
Mm.
You need to keep moving because that'll decrease your cortisol levels straight away. So, you know, and thinking about your routines, like, no, that's just as important for the person who plays every week A grade
yep.
in cricket or whatever it is. Routines are really important because they provide consistency.
Yeah, they anchor so you, then, don't they?
Yeah. So then if I have a bad performance today, but I know I've done everything the same, sometimes it's just a, you know, it's an out of the box bad performance. But if I do different things every single week, it's very hard for me to then to identify what caused my problem today.
Yep.
So that's why routines allow us to much quicker figure out maybe what caused this.
Yep.
Or to very quickly say, and I'll say this sometimes to the elite performers in every sport, sometimes you just have a shocker.
Yeah.
And you know what? We can spend hours overanalyzing this if you really want to, or we can go, you're very consistent. This was a shocker. Who knows why? We've checked all our main boxes. You've slept well. You've done everything else well. You know what? Let's just move on from this. It's not worth the over-analysis. And the other thing I think with whether you're elite or a weekend warrior is the things we worry about, acknowledge what your fears are. Okay, so what if we lose? Okay, well, what if you lose? What's going to happen?
Yep.
The world's not going to end. The people who love you aren't going to stop loving you. Your parents aren't going to kick you out of home because you lost a cricket match or a tennis match. So, you know what? If you lose, I just say to people, have you ever lost before? And they're like, yep. And I'm like, well, it couldn't have been too bad because you're still playing.
Yeah. Perspective, so, I guess. Perspective.
Yeah, it's very much perspective. Most of the things we worry about have already happened and we survive them. Or if they're that bad, talk about them and go, okay, if that happens, what would you like to do?
Yep.
So I'll go through that with our Olympic guys for sure because, you know, I want them to dream about winning a gold medal and all that because that's a motivator for them. But if they also – so we'll say, okay, if you do really well, this is what happens. This is how we'll – if you do have a great heat and we know you've made a final, this is how we're going to prepare for that and this is what we'll focus on. If you have a shocker, this is what – so we cover every scenario.
Yeah.
So it'd be the same for your weekend people. Think about what you're worried about. Has it happened before? If it has, clearly you managed it. Even if it's a grand final, what if we lose? Well, if you lose, you'll actually feel pretty shit and disappointed. And that's okay because it meant something to you. So I would be surprised if you didn't feel disappointed.
Yep.
And that's okay to feel like that. If you're still feeling like that 6 weeks on, we've probably got a problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the next few days or the next week, if you're disappointed because you missed an opportunity that was important for you, I'm fine with that. But just let's make sure you stay functional.
How do you go watching other athletes on TV that you haven't worked with or that you don't know? Are you fairly good at reading their body language and going, I reckon this person's about to lose the shit, or this person is actually, I can see this person mentally gearing up for this. They're ready to go. Can you read it?
Yeah, it's funny. That's such a good question because often if people sit with me at different sporting events, I watch the game very differently or watch the performance very differently.
I can imagine. And
I don't even realize I'm saying it. I'm like, oh, they're about to lose it here and 2 seconds later. And someone will look at me because I'm watching different sports.
Yes. Yeah.
And you can just – I watch, you know, like a team that when you see a run on and I'll watch the behavior of the other team and I'm like, okay, they've stopped communicating. They're not talking to each other.
Yep.
Watch an AFL team when they get 6-7 goals down. When the team that's down gets a goal, no one goes around them.
Yep.
they stop, you know, celebrating their goals and all that sort of stuff. So you can see the disconnect. You can see when it happens.
Yep.
If a tennis player is playing and they're not doing so well, I watch them when they're sitting down and I can see how long they take. You know, they're waiting for the whole break before they stand up, or they're getting up early because they're doing really well. So I definitely watch performances very differently.
I can imagine. Jack, I know you're pressed for time. I don't want to hold you up any longer, but just have you got any examples that you can mention perhaps, or people that you've worked with that have displayed, you know, really, really strong mental applications, and people that have sort of, I guess, managed themselves mentally really well that you've learnt from, or that you would use as examples of that? That you can name, if you're allowed.
Yeah, I mean,
to.
there's probably been a couple that have been a little bit more public about working with me. So, you know, like if you look at someone like an Adam Treloar, he's been quite public about his anxiety. And that was in the documentary that Collingwood did. And I look at someone like that and just, you know, to get up and play every single week knowing what he went through, which he's told his story. Like, to me, that is the most special part of my job, is seeing someone just perform amazing, but, you know, have a really tough week. But then, you know, it's also, it's your weekend warrior who I know that they've just lost someone close to them, or they're going through a really hard time at work, but they'll give you a buzz and they'll just say, you know, I played amazing on the weekend. You know, I got man of the match for hockey or whatever. That every day I see examples of that.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that's just as strong and just as resilient as your people who are out there doing it every day. And I think the more of these elite athletes that are opening up about their own mental health battles, or, you know, their stresses. I mean, I'm also lucky, I'm with a club like Storm that's so successful. And you see someone like a Cameron Smith who cops it all the time.
Mm.
And yet, you know, he comes into the club and he does all the things that everybody else does, in terms of he doesn't ask for special treatment, and, you know, he's nice to everybody, and you watch him and I listen to him in team meetings, and you can see the intelligence, you can see the understanding and stuff like that. And I hate it when I see athletes that, you know, as a person, and you know the hard yards they do. So that's a different type of resilience as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's so many examples.
Yeah, I'd imagine
that you can say, and a lot of them you guys see just as much as we see, because they're quite open with their stories now once the performance is finished.
Yeah, yeah. Jack, this has been a great chat. I'm going to wrap it up because I know you've got appointments to get to, but I appreciate your time. Now I'm going to
no problem.
I'm going to put some connections in the show notes for people to reach out to you if they want to. I'm not sure whether you do private work or not, but are you happy for people to connect with you on that note?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest place to find me is at Olympic Park at the Sports Medicine Centre. So
okay,
that's
cool.
One-on-one, yeah, clinic stuff.
All right. Well, I'll put that in the show notes, but I'm sure I'm sure you're a busy lady, but I'm also acutely aware that there's a lot of people that would love to access your skills and the things that you do. So thank you very much for doing this episode. It's been a great chat.
Oh,
I think,
no problem.
I think we've left a few things still to talk about, so we might connect again down the track.
Yeah, absolutely. Just get in touch. No problem.
Thanks, Jackie.
All good. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Australian Fitness Podcast is all about some education, insight, inspiration, motivation, lessons and learnings from myself and the various fitness professionals that I interview on this podcast. To help me get the message across, I'll be tapping into the minds and careers of other successful fitness experts to see just how they go about their trade. I'd love for you, the listener, to connect with the Australian Fitness Podcast, so please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at the Australian Fitness Podcast. If you have any comments or questions or would like to make contact, you can do so at info@australianfitnesspodcast.com.au. Finally, I am a working strength and conditioning coach, so if you want to reach out to me for professional services, programs, education and seminars, you can do so via email russell@russelljarrett.com.au. Thanks for listening.